Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
One reason to be happy that it's June 1st, May was a really disappointing month for the economy. We'll go over some of the stats, including the monthly jobs report just out this morning, always closely watched, especially in an election year, and so bad today compared to what was expected. Daniel Gross, business columnist for Yahoo Finance, is here with his take on what's happening now, wrapped inside a world of optimism in which he lives about the long term. He has a new book called Better, Stronger, Faster, The Myth of American Decline and the Rise of a New Economy. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, it's good to be here, Brian.
And oh boy, I can't wait for the future after reading your book. But unfortunately, we have to begin with the present. The May jobs report, just 69,000 new jobs for the month. Economists had predicted an already modest 150,000 new jobs. It turns out to be less than half of that. What do you make of it?
Well, you know, people always advise not to make too much of one month's, but, you know, this was really awful. And then they say, well, look at the trend. The trend ain't so hot either. In the past couple of years, we have created 4.3 million private sector jobs in this country, which is not too awful. But we continue to have a crisis of unemployment, not enough jobs to go around. The indicators were sort of flashing green. The Labor Department publishes a figure of job openings. And at the end of March, there were 3.7 million jobs open in the U.S., the highest level that's been at since, I believe, 2008. First-time unemployment claims have been trending lower, which means, you know, fewer people getting fired, more jobs opening. You would think that would lead to more hiring, but something is plainly broken about the way that demand and openings translate into filling payroll jobs.
A mismatch of skills and employer need?
I think there's some of that. I think some of it is geographic. There are tens of thousands of jobs open in North Dakota where nobody lives. If you own a home in Detroit and want to relocate somewhere, you will have a very tough time selling your house and getting out of that mortgage. So there's some of that. A lot of it has to do with uncertainty over demand. People are reluctant to hire because they don't think the demand will be there. Companies, and we're going to talk about my book in a little bit, companies have really got religion about efficiency and productivity, which means they are continually thinking about ways to do more with less labor. So that's something else going on. But whatever the reasons, you know, this is where we are. We are not creating a sufficient number of jobs. And it has big political ramifications and big social and economic ramifications, too.
This report also did revise downward the number of jobs that were created in April when we had the same conversation on the show a month ago. We were talking about 115,000 jobs in April, and we were saying, oh, yeah, not great, not terrible, 115,000. Well, now they say it was really 77,000 jobs, which is really pretty bad. Interestingly, non-farm employment for women rose by 95,000 in May, which means that men must have been losing jobs while women were gaining jobs.
Yeah, you know, people talked about the man session or the herd session. One of the things when you look at this report, we are primarily a service economy. Prior to this year, the strength in employment was in things like manufacturing and a lot of business services, which tend to be have more male, and things like healthcare were growing, but education, there were a lot of cutbacks in government jobs. Those are some fields in which women tend to predominate a little more. This month, service jobs growth was higher. There wasn't so much growth in things like mining, manufacturing, natural gas extraction, those sorts of things, which really do tend to be more male-dominated.
And also, I noticed that the number of people jobless for 6 months or more rose to 5.5 million in May from 5.1 million. That makes up about 43% of the unemployed jobless for more than 6 months.
Yep. That, again, not good. There, if you look carefully, you could find some rays of light if you want. The household survey, you know, they call people up and say, you know, are you working? Is someone in your house working? That's how they derive the unemployment rate. One of the things that's been happening in recent months is that people have been dropping out of the labor force, and it's been shrinking. And that can help make the unemployment rate go down even when we don't add jobs. Well, in this past month, the labor force grew by 100,000. That's
people encouraged enough to look.
People kind of getting in off the sidelines and saying, you know what, I'm in the market for a job. And, you know, several hundred thousand more said, I'm working. That is a less reliable indicator. What we're really interested in is payroll jobs, people who have paychecks, not whether someone, you know, you call 40,000 people at home and then extrapolate something. But that component of the data shows that more people came into the workforce, which is generally a positive sign. That's seasonally adjusted, so it's not simply saying, oh, a bunch of people graduated from school. And so the number of people who identified themselves as working also higher. But, you know, the focus, as it should be, is on payroll jobs, because that's what, you know, people don't want part-time work. They don't really want to be self-employed. People overwhelmingly like to have a payroll job with benefits, vacation, et cetera.
Daniel Gross, business columnist for Yahoo Finance. We'll get into the bigger picture optimism that his new book is full of. It's called Stronger, Better. Did I get the first word right?
Better.
Stronger, better, stronger, faster. And we'll see why you see better, stronger, faster coming out of this, let's say, slower, weaker, worse kind of month. In a couple of minutes as we go. But on some of the other individual indicators here, jobless claims increased in May. That came out yesterday. The economy grew more slowly in the first quarter than previously estimated, under 2% annual growth in the first quarter. Stocks had their worst month since September. We mentioned that one. A silver lining, oil got cheaper again due to this other downbeat economic news.
Yeah, so oil has really come off the boil. Gas prices are falling. But, you know, the employment data, which is going to dominate the headlines and especially the political headlines today, was one piece of information we got today. Today was like a sort of Super Bowl Sunday for economic data. The first of the month, we get car sales. Cars are the biggest retail sector in the U.S., the biggest manufacturing, up quite strongly from last year. Chrysler up 30%. GM and Ford up 10, 15%. Toyota up 80%. That's a very big, to me, indicator, not just for consumers' willingness to spend, make big-ticket purchases, the availability of credit, but when we make cars in this country, good things happen. Ford has announced that they are upping production. Construction spending for April came out. That was up, including spending on residential investment. So housing is starting. Housing prices may still be falling, but housing activity, sales, construction, on the rise. We got the ISM Manufacturing Index, which basically is indicating if the manufacturing sector is expanding or contracting, came in a little weaker, but still positive growth mode. And we got personal income data for April, also on the rise. So if you were to take out the employment figure from today and just look at all those other pieces, people say, yeah, that's indicative of an economy that seems to be growing at 2.5%, which is, I think, sort of where we are.
So do you think that the media put too much focus on this singular number, this monthly jobs report that comes out on the first Friday of the next month, each month, and places too much political weight on it, or maybe creates too much political weight for it in the election year?
Well, I think they, you know, look, jobs, it's a very powerful number. Everybody understands it. And yes, the media make a lot of it, but the markets do too. Right, because the markets will react to this number, you know, stocks going down 1 or 2%, bonds going in a certain direction, which is real money to people, and so you have to cover that.
And we see the Dow down on this news 170 the last time I looked.
Yeah, that's 1.5%. I mean, that's to me that again that is non-tragic.
Talk to me for a minute about interest rates, which keep going down in the face of all this bad news for private sector growth. 15-year mortgages have dropped under 3%. You can get according to what I read yesterday, you get a 15-year mortgage for 2.97%. Treasury bonds are paying almost zero. Is that a combination of market forces and government policy?
Well, I think there are a few things. First of all, there's a degree to which a lot of these mortgage rates are illusory because the standards are much higher. They require a lot more home equity. The process goes much more quickly. And frankly, banks aren't all that eager to commit to lend money for that long at these rates, right? Because a lot of things could go wrong for them. So the headline rates seem to be falling, but a typical borrower, when they go out, may find that it's not all it's cracked up to be.
They're not anxious to lend at these low rates because they see risk in any long-term lending, and they're not going to make that much money because the rates are low.
Right.
Is that why another stat that I saw this week had to do with small business lending being down, so it's harder than it was 6 months ago for small businesses to get loans, which, of course, would impede economic growth?
I think on the business side, it's more about demand. Banks have really recapitalized themselves. The FDIC that said in the first quarter, America's banking industry made profits of $35 billion. They put a lot of the credit problems behind them. They get free money from the Federal Reserve. They charge a much higher – they're not charging 3% to lend to small businesses. They're charging 6%, 7%, and 8%. And I think in a lot of instances, it may be a case of the demand not there. But to your question of why interest rates are so low. So some of it is policy. The Federal Reserve is saying – the interest rate recontrol, which is lending to banks overnight for a day or two, is close to zero and will be that way. So that's the short-term interest rates are low because the Fed is dictating they won't. You would start to go out longer, five-year bonds, seven-year bonds. The Fed has been buying some of those in Operation Twist, its latest effort at what they call quantitative easing. So that's keeping those down. The farther you go out, the less it's about what the government doing and the more it's about people's concerns and expectations about growth and inflation and also fear. Whenever something bad happens in the world, people around the world buy U.S. government bonds. This is the safest place to be. It's like putting money under your mattress, except you get paid a few percentage points to do it. So fear of slow growth in China, fear of social unrest in Asia, European Union falling apart, all this stuff spurs different people around the world to buy government bonds, short-term, long-term, et cetera. And that has the effect of pushing interest rates down.
The next bubble?
No, I don't think it's a bubble. A bubble is like, you know, web van. Something can go from being worth $1 billion to be worth literally zero in the course of a couple months. If interest rates rise, the value of your bond falls, but they can't go to zero. And if you simply hold on to them and collect your interest payments you're going to get what you're supposed to get out of it.
Are you a fan, by the way, of Ben Bernanke's quantitative easing, basically all this cheap money, low interest rate policy?
I think it was the right thing to do. We invest, I think, too much in the powers of the Fed. And I think this is the problem with, you know, so many macroeconomists today said, you know, because the Fed isn't doing X, we will never get out of this. The Federal Reserve is one actor, a very important one. It can print money. It can do all sorts of things. But its activity can easily be counteracted by what's going on in Congress, for example, by what's happening in states and cities. We've seen government has cut 1 million jobs in the past 2 years. Now, these are firing school teachers, et cetera, which completely unnecessary. Public construction spending is at the lowest level it's been since 2006. You know, what is the economic case for not spending money on roads and bridges? Those are choices made in cities, states, and in Washington. Some of them are inevitable because states and cities can't run deficits.
Austerity versus growth, running in the opposite direction of Ben Bernanke's quantitative easing.
So it's like an engine where, you know, he's got his foot on the gas and some of these other people have their foot on the brake.
All right. Now, despite all the numbers that we're seeing in the U.S. this week, my guest Daniel Gross is bullish for the long term. And that's the really big question that has so many people worried. That is whether the U.S. is simply a country in historic economic decline now and for the rest of our lives and our children's lives. He argues no in his new book, Better, Faster, Stronger. And we'll talk about that right after we take a short break. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, Daniel Gross from Yahoo Finance with us. We're talking about the very disappointing new jobs report, just 69,000 new jobs in May when economists were predicting 150,000 and more than 200,000 needed to do more than tread water. And yet his new book is called Better, Stronger, Faster, The Myth of American Decline and the Rise of a New Economy. And Daniel, first, despite the May numbers, you see the recovery since 2009 in very positive terms. How so, with unemployment still at 8.2, underemployment still at 15%?
So we have a lot of bad metrics, including employment. But when you look at, you know, A, our markets, which have essentially doubled since March 2009, the fact that our economy has regained its peak size, it's now bigger than it was before. If we were in decline, we would be shrinking. The ability to engage with the world. The U.S. is the world's number one exporter. A lot of people feel really bad because they look overseas and everywhere else is growing more rapidly, and that must be a zero-sum game. And I think what we've seen is this economy kind of transition from one that was really reliant on, you know, home construction and people borrowing against their homes and calling it income, to one in which it's more about making things, selling things, not just to people at home who are buying with their credit cards, but to people around the world. And our private sector, in particular big companies, but also I have examples in my book about smaller companies, has been quite good about engaging consumers through exports, through having them come here to consume our stuff, to meeting them where they are. Our brands and business models travel quite well. And, you know, I've spent some time in Japan, and people make all these comparisons. I think we are nothing like Japan.
The narrative of American decline, however, sees big historical forces shifting and not in our favor. And it's beyond what Obama does or Romney might do. The growth and stability we had in the decades after World War II was unsustainable, for one thing, according to this narrative, because we were the only economy standing after World War II devastated Europe and Japan, and the rest of Asia hadn't really yet started to grow. Plus, we've had 30 years of a house of cards, economic growth based on financial sector cleverness creating bubbles, including the housing bubble, borrowing against your home and calling it income, not a real economic foundation. You want to address that much of the narrative of decline?
Well, what I find is that the declinists came out in force in 2009, 2010, after we had suffered this near catastrophic fall. Where were these guys in 2002? They were telling us everything was fantastic. They were talking about the Bush boom and the Reagan boom and the dot-com boom and all these things. These trends of median income not growing, that started, you know, in the 80s. When you look, compare 2009 to 1999, we had fewer jobs in 2009 than we did in 1999. The markets were below where they were. So we had our lost decade. It was the period from sort of 2000 to 2010. And so then the question is, what have we done since then, since hitting bottom? And I think the bounce back in many areas has been impressive. For my colleagues who focus on Washington and New York, this kind of, you know, corridor of misery, and finance and real estate and banking and that sort of toxic intersection, they can't see anything good that's happened in the past few years because that's not what they're focused on. But if you get out of this zone and you look at different parts of the country and different parts of the world, you can see things that are doing quite well. I've talked about monthly exports have risen almost 50% since hitting bottom in April 2009. We export about $140 billion of agricultural products. We're the Saudi Arabia of grain and food, and the rest of the world growing richer, eating better, higher prices. These are good times in North Dakota and South Dakota.
And yet now we have globalization of manufacturing. As we've heard a million times, America can't compete on wages. For the mass employment of people without college educations, which is still most Americans, you go to great pains in your book to downplay the importance of that.
Well, I do have a chapter where I talk about reshoring and onshoring, insourcing, whatever you want to call it. What's happening is that China is getting more expensive. Their currency is appreciated about 25%. In the coastal areas where they do a lot of manufacturing, wages are rising 15, 20% a year. It's costing more money to ship. And I think a lot of businesses that just kind of said, hey, let's go find cheap labor, didn't take into account the fact that okay, say you make softball bets and your selling season is 2 months and it takes you 6 to 8 weeks to get your product out, you have a problem if you run out. So I have an anecdote in my book of a company that has brought production back of sort of high-end softball bats back to Minnesota. Same thing with if you're seasonal and you have to do quick inventory turns, if your products are very bulky like washing machines, it's starting to make more sense to manufacture some of them here. Boston Consulting Group has done this report called Remade in America. They say that up to 3 million jobs will be coming back here, even if a small fraction of them do. And they are. That is a positive. The larger point is that manufacturers and companies are running out of places that have the combination of cheap labor and the infrastructure necessary to get stuff out quickly. You can go to Bangladesh or Laos, but you can't get your products out of there quickly. And so these guys all have matrices where they check off where it makes sense. And for some companies, it's making more sense to do that here.
Daniel Gross, my guest on WNYC, his new book, Better, Stronger, Faster, The Myth of American Decline and the Rise of a New Economy. And listeners, we want you in on this. Questions for Daniel Gross, I did it again. Are you as optimistic as he is? 212-433-WNYC. See, that's not a lisp. That's just kind of a Freudian slip. Conflating Daniel's name with what he's here promoting the reality of. 212-433-WNYC or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Can the Bulls join the Bears in this conversation in our national conversation, despite the monthly jobs report out today? 212-433-9692. Fred and Muncie are on WNYC. Hello, Fred.
Hello, gentlemen. I really value your guest because I think he's put his finger right on the market, which is we are a great people, this American public, and will overcome in spite of what our government does sometimes. But the question I have is, one, where did the TARP money go to, and why wasn't it effective? And secondly, in terms of the VAT tax that they keep talking about, as a middle-class wage earner, more of the percentage of money that will be taken out of my pocket if there's a VAT tax is a great deal more in terms mm-hmm. of spendable income than someone who's in a higher tax bracket.
All right, Fred. Now, I don't know that we want to get into the VAT, mm-hmm. the value added or kind of a national sales tax, because this is not seriously on the table whether Obama or Romney is elected, right?
I don't think so.
But in terms of where the TARP money went, well, people are saying now, the government made money on TARP.
I do have one chapter on policy. People said, TARP $700 billion and we've lost it all. Actually, only $400 billion went out. A couple hundred billion of that went to the banks. We bought shares. Almost all that money has come back. Between dividends, interest, and the warrants that we sold, taxpayer has returned a small profit on the capital purchase program, which was the central component. These other measures, many of these other measures, to support the money market fund industry and commercial paper and the FDIC's guarantees, all those things, which are sort of selling insurance on financial assets, the taxpayer turned a small profit on them. The TARP did not return lending to the situation it was in 2005 and 2006, which, of course, was an insane level. That's like saying, to restore Rome, we got to get back to what Caligula was doing.
But, this is another way to ask Fred's question. And maybe this is even the way he meant it. I'm not sure. Not where did all our tax dollars go, mm-hmm. because the tax dollars, as you say, are being repaid by the banks. But where did all the TARP money go into the black hole of the banks themselves? If they got recapitalized this much, but now they're so reluctant to lend.
Well, this is sort of a classic case. In 2007, they lent and invested and behaved as if nothing could go wrong. And the natural thing after you've had a near-death experience is to act and behave as if nothing could go right. So there's a reluctance to lend on their part. They're shoring up their, they would give a loan to anybody who walked in the door. Now they're asking 50 questions of anybody mm-hmm. who walks in the door. So that is a natural sort of thing that happens when you've had this kind of crash we've had, and some of it is a low level of demand. There's more to our economy than finance, and there's more to consumption than borrowing to do it. We have seen credit card debt fall by a couple $100 billion. It's back to the level it was in 2004. And people said, well, how can retail sales rise when credit card balances are falling? This is how Americans finance their purchases. In fact, retail sales are now at a record level. And what's happened is people have changed their behavior. In 2009, they hoarded money. They stopped spending. They cut up credit cards. They defaulted on a lot of debt. They, you know, started making coffee at home. They stopped buying bottled water, all the things people do that the personal finance shows tell you to save money. And they've rebuilt their balance sheets. On aggregate, we now have much less debt, more savings, and are spending more, but we're using debit instead of credit.
And that's part of the hope for the future. If it was previously built on a house of cards and bubbles, that now a new foundation that's more real is being built. And the big question is, will the manufacturing and the other things that actually will generate sales and income and money floating around and then growth beyond 2% actually settle in?
Right. So I think we have a much more sustainable economy than we did in 05 and 06 when it was all dependent on home equity, what they call mortgage equity withdrawal, which is you borrow against your house and then you know to go to the Olive Garden. More people are eating at home, but they're paying for their groceries with their wages. And one of the things that's happening now is that in the early parts of this recovery, the economy started to expand in summer of 09. The consumer was detracting from economic growth. They were spending less, and it was really business, investment, manufacturing, responding to this global growth that was driving it. What we're seeing now is that business investment is tailing off a little bit, concerned about global growth now, so maybe a little less exports, but consumers are starting to pick up the baton. So auto sales are up very strongly this year. That's a very big number. Retail sales continue to rise, and we're starting to see housing activity, housing starts, housing sales, not prices, but housing activity rise. That's also driven by consumers.
Which would, in the long run, push prices to rise because demand creates a rising price. I don't know that we always want home prices to be rising. Maybe there's a silver lining to this.
No, well, I also think that our housing economy is much more sustainable than it was. The median price has fallen by 35%. So that means you need less, you know, your monthly nut is going to be much smaller than it was 5 years
ago. It's bad if you already own your home. It's good if you're trying to get into the market. Gina in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Gina.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question to the guest is whether, in his look at the U.S. economy, whether he has seen the clean energy economy growing significantly, and if he anticipates that that may be a part of the economic recovery.
Absolutely. You know, last year was a record year for solar installation, for wind power. These are domestic industry. It is a domestic resource. It mobilizes manufacturing and service. It does depend on subsidies. But I think we are increasingly, you know, it's not just green energy. It's energy efficiency. Again, the company I discovered in the course of this, it's called Big Belly Solar. They make solar-powered trash compactors. So you put the garbage in there, and when it rises up, it hits a beam, and then it compacts it down, and it draws the power from the sun. So it doesn't require any subsidy from the government. It's manufactured in the U.S. It helps cities with their budget woes because it decreases the need to collect by, you know, 60-70%. It gets trucks off the road. It has all these positive things. Their sales doubled every year since the recession began. They sold 900 to Philadelphia. They sold 1,600 to Chicago. Imagine if they could sell them to New York. I use that as an example, not because they are going to employ thousands of people, but it's a product that helps other people save money, and it shows that you take a system like garbage collection, and we have the resources to improve it and make it run better, and you look at all our other systems, we have the capacity to do that as well. It's a question of will, financing, funding.
But in terms of the larger idea of a green economy, people have been waiting since the 70s for solar energy and other renewals to be scalable, as they call it, meaning to be able to replace oil and coal and other things on a mass basis. Mm-hmm. And the technology certainly hasn't been developed yet to sell it like that in an affordable way. Do you see that changing? And in a macroeconomic sense, do you see that as a driver of the next generation of growth, or is it more of a niche?
Well, it's still a niche, but you know, Iowa gets 20% of its electricity from wind. New Jersey has a ton of solar. It's stuff that's on the margin, but it's finding applications. The real thing that's changing, and again, I talk in the book about internal resources and our ability to be efficient and productive and innovate. That's an internal resource. But we also have lots of real internal resources, including natural gas. So fracking, which is this controversial practice by which we, you know, get the natural gas out of the rocks, is controversial. But our production has increased. And what this means is that we're now using natural gas to create electricity instead of coal. It's displacing coal very rapidly. That's good for the environment. And it also means now that we have more natural gas at home, companies are saying, oh, you know, we used to make plastics and chemicals. You would put that plant in Saudi Arabia because they have cheap natural gas. Now we're going to build that plant here. That leads to more construction jobs, et cetera. Now we're going to start using natural gas as a transportation fuel. So companies are taking cars and buses and building, you know, that mobility and natural gas. That's something that's happening now.
We have a few minutes left. And then we're going to talk to John Patrick Shanley, the playwright, about the final play in his Church and State trilogy. Many of you know Doubt, which was such a big hit. And his new one is set in the Bronx, having to do with religion and the housing bubble. So John Patrick Shanley coming up.
Shouldn't Doubt have been the title of our segment?
Maybe. Doubt the Conventional Wisdom, a.k.a. Daniel Gross's new book, Better, Stronger, Faster, The Myth of American Decline and the Rise of a New Economy. But let me get you to get a couple of other things out here real quick. You just talked about natural gas. Promoters of fracking say this is good for us economically because the U.S. is the Saudi Arabia of natural gas. You write in your book, and you said it here earlier, that the U.S. is to food what Saudi Arabia is to oil. And yet we think of the agricultural economy as having been 19th century. Is food going to be a big export product, a generator of growth?
It is. You know, we think of food, especially here in New York, as you know, neighborhood gardens and small scale people growing vegetables. When you talk about grains and you go where sort of three or four people can farm 10,000 acres, we have industrialized the process of raising grains and pigs and chickens, et cetera. And as the rest of the world, you know, they're in China, their agriculture, first of all, they don't have much arable land. They have problems with water, but they also don't have this efficiency. We have spent a century mechanizing our agriculture and turning it into a real industry. And we are now finding that with each passing year, there are tens of millions of more people who have the capacity to eat better. So to a very large degree, we are feeding the world.
And you mentioned in the book that we are what you call the category killers in certain major exports besides food, airplanes, chemicals, missiles. We'll leave aside the ethics of that. But I noticed the other day when the stock market went down over fears about Europe that the stock to go down the most was Caterpillar, the big truck and heavy machinery manufacturer, which means that they're selling a lot of stuff in Europe.
Sure. So, you know, Boeing is one of our biggest exporters. They are planes that cost a few $100 million each. For some of the research in my book, I went to General Electric's plant in South Carolina where they make turbines for power plants. These are $25 million pieces of equipment. They were making 90 this calendar year, every single one of them going overseas. So we make a lot of what the world wants. And we also, I think people in New York realize this. Who is going to recapitalize us bail us out of all the poor decisions we made? The U.S. leads the world in foreign direct investment. So every American is telling you how they're investing overseas. Every rich person and company around the world wants to be here. So we hear about, you know, when Sandy Weill sold his apartment for $88 million, of course it was a Russian buyer. This is happening with trophy real estate, but you know, Fiat took over Chrysler and is now rebuilding it. Chinese companies are building factories here. You look at tourism. That's another form of export. As people make money around the world, they are expressing a very high degree of interest in buying what we're making. And to me, if you were a nation in decline, that wouldn't be happening.
Daniel Gross, Yahoo Finance business columnist, his new book, better, stronger, faster, the myth of American decline, and the rise of a new economy? Let's hope you're right.
Let's hope.
Thank you very much. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, we have playwright John Patrick Shanley on Storefront Church, exploring religion and the housing bubble and set in the Bronx. It's the final installment of his Church and State trilogy that started with Doubt. Stay with us.